Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Growing up, Christine Marty Ochola spent a lot of time in her mom's hair salon.
So the hairdressing salon brat, if you want to call it that.
And her most vivid memory?
I just always remembered the smell of, you know, ammonia and the smell of hair burning.
Christine grew up in Kenya, and many of her mom's clients wanted their curly hair straightened.
Sometimes, unfortunately, you know, women's hair just being straightened to the point where, you know, they were seeing hair loss. But people were searching for a certain look. Growing up as a Black woman, and maybe I can add another layer there as an African Black woman, most of what, you know, we grew up seeing in mainstream media presented, let me say, as beautiful, were Caucasian women with long flowing hair. You know, when you're presented with the idea of what beauty is supposed to look like, it becomes very challenging if genetically that's not how you're oriented. You're born with curly hair, you're born with, you know, hair that, you know, when you wash it, sometimes it just curls up into a knot. And so it translates into, what does beauty mean?
What does it mean, and what are people willing to risk for it? On this episode, we're listening to stories about our perception of beauty, how we see ourselves and how others see us, and why we so often put our health and well-being on the line to attain something we perceive as ideal. Let's continue with our hair. Christine Marty Ochola spent her childhood with the sting of ammonia in her nostrils. The smell of burning hair permeated her mom's salon. As she got older, she too straightened her hair, because all the other girls and women did it. She became a scientist. She moved to the U.S. and started working in cancer research. Having straight hair was part of her look, until something changed her mind.
I'm not proud of this, but I will tell you that I started thinking about that, and I know exactly when. It was 16 years ago. I was preparing to have my first child, and I just kept thinking, how am I going to be able to take care of my hair? And I also have a child. and I lived in a community where there weren't too many beauty shops that could take care of my hair, because I would go to places and they'd be like, well, we really cannot take care of your hair. Your hair type is not one that we've been trained on. And so at that point, I had to really look within and say, you know, my hair is going to be my hair. And I decided to go into locks. So I still have locks.
Her hair is now in shoulder-length, tight rows of dreadlocks, and allowing it to grow into its natural beauty meant no longer having to drive 2 hours to get to her stylist. But it came at a different price.
Part of what went through my head at that time, and it was a check mark that many, I think, Black women go through, is one, how am I going to be perceived at work? Will people struggle with this look that I now have?
Christine says she did get bad reactions, and some of them came from her own family.
I remember going for some meeting once, and I was with, you know, one of my great aunts. And she said, you know, is it that you don't have money to make your hair? I was a college professor, by the way, you know. But it was like, are people going to listen to you if you walk into a high-powered meeting with your hair looking like that? You know you need to perm it, and so that people can actually listen to what you say.
When she was out and about, people sometimes asked her if she smoked pot. One year, she traveled to France to present research, and at the airport in Paris, security officers detained her, searched her luggage, and asked if she was a Jamaican drug dealer. Christine says since then, people have become more accepting of different hairstyles. But still, hair remains a difficult topic. As a cancer researcher, she had also become deeply concerned about the ingredients that were part of so many hair products that people were using all the time, sulfates or parabens.
Those products are known to interfere with estrogen regulation, and there have been correlatory studies with breast cancer progression. So you start asking yourself, what are we consuming?
So when the opportunity arose to use her science and research background to work in the hair care industry, she wanted to do things differently.
I mean, I'll be honest with you, it's such a challenging industry.
Christine is now the CEO of Nuel Hair, and the company's goal is to provide products with only natural ingredients, like oils, and to be really transparent about exactly what's in them.
There's been so much misinformation out there around hair care products. We're really looking at health. Our main indicator was health.
Christine also wants the products to emphasize people's natural beauty.
Enable them to just love their best selves from a young age.
She also wants people to pay more attention to all the ingredients that are in common beauty products, because she says there is so little regulation in the cosmetic industry. Most cosmetic products don't require FDA approval before they hit the market. And in general, the space has very little oversight. In addition, we're often not really discerning consumers.
You know, when you go out and buy a tube of lipstick, you're not usually saying, let me see, which FD color is in there? And is it safe, right? You're just like, oh, I like that color. Not to mention you need like a magnifying glass to read this stuff. You know, you're like, oh, that looks pretty. I think I'll take that. It matches my outfit. You know, most folk are not thinking, oh, wait, let me see. Does it have a paraben in there? So I think sometimes we, even when we do know what's not great for us, sometimes we set it aside in, you know, as we quest for a certain look.
I'm totally guilty of that. For example, if I want to color my hair and I go to the salon or grab a box of color at the store, I don't think about the impact on my health. I want my hair to look nice. And I'm sure lots of people feel that way. Should we be more careful? Stefan looked into that.
So with this, I'm going to do part ash, part violet. So this one is the ash.
Ashley Ferguson likes to say that being a hair colorist is being part chemist, part hair doctor, part artist. Right now, she's in chemist mode.
So I'm going to add a pinch of a silver rapid toner in it just so it's a little stronger.
We're at Danger Salon in Philadelphia. Her client, Alyssa, is going from a dirty blonde to an icy platinum blonde. Ashley has already bleached Alyssa's hair, so it's a bright, warm, yellowish blonde right now. The ash and violet will turn that warmth cool to achieve the white blonde Alyssa wants.
So if it's really more yellow, you can pick more violet. If it's more orange, you would pick more blue.
I'm in the back of the salon with Ashley as she assembles all the components.
And the peroxide activates the color. So I'm doing half 6 volume, half 10 volume.
All told, the hair dye contains a lot of ingredients.
I'm not going to be able to read half of this. Citerol alcohol, Worth 3, cocamidrixol, betaine, ammonia, PEG 40, sodium sulfate, urethroaerobic acid, phosphates, glycerol.
You are basically doing a very sophisticated organic synthesis right on top of your hair.
That's Joshing Huang.
I am a professor of material science and engineering at Northwestern University.
I asked Joshing to help me understand what's going on chemically when you're dyeing your hair. He says your hair shaft is covered in cuticle scales, like the scales on a fish or the shingles on a roof. The coloring molecules in dye are usually big.
Too big to diffuse easily into your hair.
So chemists came up with the idea to break these molecules into tiny sub-nanometer fragments, or precursors. Later, when the reaction is activated, those precursors come together to form color. When you dye your hair, you first diffuse these small fragments through the hair cuticles.
It's like how you marinate a fish.
To help the fragments get in the hair, you need an alkalinizing agent, often ammonia or an organic amine.
What they do is to open up the hair cuticle scales so that these molecules can get inside more quickly.
Is it still oxidizing?
Yep, this color sits for about 25 to 30 minutes and it'll oxidize the whole time until it's done.
As we watch Alyssa's hair turn from bright lemon to steely purple to ash gray, it smells like a chemistry experiment too. My nose is burning a little.
Do the smells ever get to you?
Maybe when I first started working, but not now. I guess I'm really used to it. There's some like lightener bags, and if you cut it, sometimes it'll mushroom cloud up, and that's like really bothersome. It can make you like lose your voice and like irritate your throat, which you want to try to just avoid doing that.
Smell is one of the ways chemicals from dyes could be getting into our bodies. Here's Melissa Pilyong, a dermatologist with the Cleveland Clinic.
One is you could absorb it in the air during the dyeing process. You know, some of it becomes aerosolized and you could inhale it into your lungs.
The other way is through the skin. Remember, to penetrate the hair cuticle, these molecules have to be teeny. And
a smaller molecule is more likely to be able to penetrate through the skin.
The chemicals could also potentially soak down through our hair follicles.
And the hair follicles are highly vascularized. It requires a lot of blood flow to grow hair.
So through our skin or hair follicles, chemicals in hair dye could get into our bloodstream. That's potentially concerning because a lot of the chemicals in hair dye are known or suspected to be linked to health issues. So you have these tiny fragments. One common one is paraphenylene diamine, or PPD, which is derived from petroleum. It often triggers allergic reactions, and it's associated with blood toxicity and birth defects. Ammonia is a respiratory irritant, and hydrogen peroxide, a skin and lung irritant. Also the reason colored hair can feel brittle and straw-like. Those are just a few of the thousands of chemicals that can be found in hair dyes. Some other scary ones are lead, a neurotoxin, formaldehyde, a known carcinogen, also linked with miscarriages, and benzene, associated with leukemia. Many other ingredients have yet to be studied, either in isolation or combination with one another. What does this mean for consumers? The short answer is, it's unclear. The scientific literature is largely inconclusive, with mixed and contradictory findings. Some studies have found that hair dyes increase the risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, leukemia, and bladder cancer, while other research suggests there's no link between hair dyes and these diseases. Melissa Pilyong, the dermatologist, says these types of studies are exceptionally hard to do.
We're looking at thousands of people, and we live such varied lives and have so many different exposures, it's really hard to determine which one might be causing which thing.
Well, what we can do, too, is, so here are your options. We can either go or
the That piece was reported by Steph Yin. And there is some research that could perhaps speak to the long-term health impact of hair dyes. That's a few studies that were done with salon workers, which found that these workers experience chronic asthma, skin irritation, and higher rates of certain cancers. Again, these were people using and handling dyes all day, every day, not people dyeing their hair like once a month. But still, some health advocates warn that this could be a canary in the coal mine. We're talking about the connection between the quest for beauty and our health. Right now, we're spending some time looking closer at all the chemicals we slap on our heads to change how our hair looks. Many African American women use relaxers to straighten their hair. We already talked about those a little bit earlier. Reporter Micah Hazel never tried relaxers. She always liked her hair natural. But in college, she became obsessed with another hair attribute, length. Here's her story.
In the Black community, long natural hair evokes marvel. For decades and from as young as elementary school, many Black women have used relaxers, powerful chemical treatments that straighten curly hair. But relaxers can also cause damage, breakage, or stunted hair growth. So the idea that if left alone, our natural hair can grow long is often seen as unbelievable.
Nicki Minaj reveals her real hair.
Beyonce's mom shared this Instagram video of her daughter's real locks.
On the September cover of O Magazine, Oprah Winfrey is sporting a more natural look.
Exactly how long our natural hair can grow and how long it takes to grow is a mystery to many Black women. Still, one way to get answers on this is to just not relax your hair. This is how I've lived, as a lifelong, kinky-haired natural.
Since you guys were toddlers, uppermost in my mind was making sure you like yourselves naturally.
This is my mom, Michelle. Raising me and my sister in the early 2000s, she had a strict rule. No relaxers would ever enter our Brooklyn home. She spent 4 hours washing and combing my hair every Sunday night until I turned 18.
When I was doing your hair, I would always be making these comments of how black your hair was, or how healthy it looked, and you know, how it felt. I always talked about it in a positive way, so like giving you the joy of your own hair.
Not having relaxed hair did get lonely sometimes. At school, I was often one of two girls in my class with natural hair. Still, since nobody looked like me, I didn't worry about how long my hair was or how it compared to other girls. Plus, my mom was very supportive of my hair, and in public, people were in awe of it.
People made a lot of comments when you were preteens and teens about your hair. And one of the things they would always say is, oh, your hair looks so beautiful, keep it like that.
When college came, I moved to upstate New York, and I brought my mother's Sunday wash routine with me. It consists of 7 steps. First, detangle the hair with a wide tooth comb and lotion. Shampoo. Condition. Apply a hair mask to add moisture. Wash out the hair mask. Add a leave-in and a heat protectant. Finally, blow dry. The washing is the easy part. For kinkier hair like mine, washing but not styling hair can lead to it getting matted and dry overnight. So it has to be styled in braids or twists. This was something I didn't prepare for. So, like in most situations, I turned to the internet. I found a ton of hairstyling videos, but I also found another type of video.
I am going to be doing a length check.
Length checks. These videos were made by women who had cut off their relaxed hair and were tracking their natural hair growth. They tug a strand of their natural hair down and mark where it reached. Nose length, shoulder length, or the goal, waist length.
So you're trying to tell me that my hair grew an inch in 3 months?
I fell down a rabbit hole of length check videos. It was addicting, watching how long, thick, and luscious these women's hair had become.
My hair grew 4 inches in 6 months.
But the more videos I watched, the more nervous I became. These were girls who just went natural. How was their hair growing faster than mine?
I'm going to discuss how I grew my hair waist length in 1 year.
I became length obsessed. Any YouTube channel I visited, I would scroll through their videos to see how fast their hair had grown over time. I became super bummed about my own hair. It didn't help that going from relaxed hair to natural hair was becoming popular offline too. Talking to friends, I'd be distracted by their thick afros. But I wasn't alone. In the comments section on YouTube, I found that Black women from across the hair spectrum were also confused about why their hair grew so slowly compared to women in these videos.
We have a false idea of like what our hair should look like because of what we see someone else's hair.
This is Sabine Bellevue, owner of Sabine's Hallway Hair Salon in Brooklyn, New York.
You have to understand, they live in a different climate than you. Their diet is different than you, depending on where they live and what they do, and their lifestyles is not like yours, and their parents are not your parents. So your hair may not look like theirs and not going to come out the same way that their hair is.
Just because we don't see the same results as the women in these videos doesn't mean our hair doesn't grow.
The hair grows a half an inch per month.
This is Kogi Porter, hair doctor, trichologist, and owner of Genetic Salon in New York City. Kogi has been doing hair for over 30 years.
There is growth that we are not seeing. Our hair grows out either in a tight C or a tight S pattern. You won't see it unless you straighten it out completely.
Okay, so climate, genes, and diet can tell us why some Black hair is longer than others. But why does length matter so much to us? Psychologist Lindsay Andre links it to something called residual trauma. Our Black ancestors have had it ingrained in them that European features like long hair are preferable. So we subconsciously are concerned when we don't have them.
There are so many factors that have been used to separate us or to place us on some type of like hierarchy. Everything from skin tone to hair texture and length to body type and curves, right? This is something that our parents and grandparents and people way into the past have been dealing with. And it's not gonna just go away.
So our obsession with length is rooted in a history way bigger than YouTube. But steps to get rid of this obsession are smaller.
My number one piece of advice is just learn to appreciate who you are and how you are. As cliche as it sounds, I think that's something that sort of needs to be repeated and understood over and over again.
Instead of drooling over bloggers on YouTube, maybe I should be listening to what my mom's been trying to get through to me for years.
You're not a child anymore. You're independent. And I'm seeing that you've grown to love yourself. So my role now is just to support, encourage, just to be there.
That was Micah Hazel reporting. We're talking about the connection between the quest for beauty and our health. Also, how our ideas of beauty influence our self-image. Your face is your calling card in so many ways. I don't usually wear makeup. I think I'm just too lazy for that. But I do spend good money on skincare lotions. And a while back, I tried something a bit more radical.
So what I'm going to do first on you is I'm going to dermaplane you. That's where I use a scalpel and I take all the dead skin off first and the fine hair comes off with it.
I'm at Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. Picture half spa, half dermatologist's office. And this is a whole new world for me. So many things you can do to your face. Microneedling, laser therapy, or dermaplaning.
I'm ready.
Okay.
Where do you want me to sit?
Okay, you can lay down.
Okay.
My esthetician, Lisa Ravitz, starts by washing my face.
I'm going to try and warm up this water.
And then with steady hands, she starts to scrape away with her scalpel.
The eyes are except, right?
Yeah, no, I'm not going to do your eye area. I can do under
I'm
your eye.
I'm going to still have eyebrows, right?
Oh, no, absolutely. If this isn't laser hair removal, I do that as well, but I'm not, that's obviously a
different
treatment.
Good, okay.
So
Lisa is very patient with me.
I promise I will not cut you. And you'd be surprised how much dead skin comes off.
It doesn't hurt at all. It's kind of relaxing. Next, she rubs a chemical on my skin. It's a retinol peel made with a form of vitamin A.
It's going to brighten the skin. It's going to help with fine lines, wrinkles.
A day later, my face started shedding furiously. But eventually, my skin looked fresh and rosy. And that's what we want, right? This was, of course, before the pandemic, long before I started covering half my face with a mask a lot of the time. I wear my mask when I'm walking around, when I'm in a storm, but when I'm at work, I can take it off once I'm at my desk, in my cubicle. And I have to be honest, that feels like a huge relief, especially on a hot and humid day. Lots of people's jobs don't allow for that kind of relief. The mask has to stay on. People working in retail or in healthcare.
It's hard. It's hard to wear a mask for that long.
That's Naomi Hatmaker. She's a nurse in Detroit, and she has to wear a mask for her entire 12-hour shift. It's uncomfortable. It gets hot and sweaty. Sometimes she gets a headache. But then Naomi noticed something else.
The mask knee came around probably within a week and a half.
Maskne. It's what people are calling the pimples and rashes that appear anywhere on your face where the mask is.
Just on my chin, under my bottom lip, and then kind of around my nose. Anywhere that really it seemed like there were like humidity buildup inside the mask.
So Naomi and lots of other people are wondering,
what is really the cause of maskne?
I asked dermatologist Anisha Patel, she also has maskne currently, and I wanted to know, first of all, is this really acne or is this just some sort of cutesy name?
Acne is when you actually have inflammation around the hair follicle. And in this case, that inflammation around the hair follicle is caused by plugging of the follicles, which then causes the inflammation around there.
So yes, for a lot of people wearing masks, this is a version of acne. Some people just get red and irritated skin in the mask area.
There's two main causes. For people who have more dry or sensitive skin, then it can actually be irritation from the material of the mask or the friction of the mask rubbing on their skin. But also just having an occlusive surface on your skin all day sort of traps the oils and moisture on the surface of your skin. And so that can also cause more of an occlusive acne where your follicles are getting plugged with the oil.
Either way, Anisha says, you want to wash your face twice daily, morning and night, and avoid wearing makeup that can contribute to irritation and buildup.
And then if your skin is more dry and irritated, then using a thick moisturizer or even Vaseline as sort of a barrier, almost like how you would for babies who get diaper rash a lot, having a thicker barrier ointment that protects your skin from the irritation is helpful.
However, if your skin is oily, Anisha says you want to do the opposite and put as little on your face as possible. She has that problem.
And I hate to say this, but I've stopped wearing sunscreen because I saw that that was related to increased acne over my nasal bridge and nose area. And that's where you really want your mask to fit the tightest so that you're not breathing out through it.
Finally, when possible, Anisha says you should be picky with your mask. Natural fibers like cotton tend to be less irritating to the skin. As for medical-grade masks, switch them out regularly to avoid buildup of oil and dead skin. Anisha Patel is an associate professor of dermatology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. We're talking about beauty, our perceptions of it, and how all of that ties into our well-being and health. The plastic surgery industry is booming once again after a slowdown due to the pandemic. Some of it seems to be inspired by people seeing themselves on the screen all the time during video meetings, noticing perhaps some sagging, new wrinkles, or a double chin. Women account for the vast majority of cosmetic surgery business, but research shows men are increasingly getting in on this too. Reporter Liz Tung looked into this last year.
Who are the guys driving up plastic surgery statistics? To find out, I visited a plastic surgeon named Brannon Clater.
Hey, Liz.
Hi.
Clater, how you doing? Well, come on in here and drop
Thanks.
A beer.
Brannon runs his own practice in Media, Pennsylvania. It's a well-heeled suburb near Philadelphia.
I can be injecting Botox in here. That's a very comfortable chair.
And he says he's definitely noticed growing interest among men.
This trend has been going on for more than 4 years. And it's just growing.
Brannon says about 15 to 20% of his patients these days are male.
They are fathers, they are business owners, they are successful professionals, somebody that is very comfortable with themselves, but feels that there's this one little area they'd like to just tweak.
Others come in on the heels of a major life change. For instance, a guy in his 60s or 70s.
Who may be a widower and looking to really get back into the dating world, but they look at themselves and they say, I see some things about me that don't match how young I feel inside.
Brannon does some body work, liposuction, breast reduction, stuff like that. But he says most of his male patients are focused on their faces.
Certainly, one of the leading procedures we do is facelifts.
He says a lot of male patients also come in to get rid of double chins, otherwise known as turkey waddles, and for blepharoplasties, a procedure that lifts droopy eyelids.
And it can really make you look like you've just had your best night's sleep.
Brannon says he's not sure what's driving this growth in men getting plastic surgery. There aren't any studies on it yet, at least none that we could find, but he has a few ideas. And his number one suspect? Smartphones.
Effectively, people are walking around with a mirror at arm's length all the time.
A mirror that can take pictures and post them instantly to social media.
There are many, many more photographs being taken and shared immediately. Patients will come in and say, I hate being in these photographs because my neck looks so bad.
Another big reason Brannon thinks more men are getting cosmetic procedures done is that people are living longer. which means they need to work longer too.
They are not ready for retirement, but people are starting to ask them and say, you know, when are you retiring? And so they come to us saying, you know, I really want to be able to project that youthful persona, a sense of dynamism, sense of vibrancy.
So what do Brandon's patients say about their reasons for going under the knife? I decided to ask one, Bill Strohauer. He's a weight loss physician.
Weight loss and weight control. We see the cheaters, you know. Angels and martyrs don't need to be here.
As you can probably tell, Bill is kind of a quirky guy. He's thin with glasses, cleft chin, and strawberry blonde hair. But a couple of years ago, when Bill looked in the mirror, he didn't see any of that. Instead, he saw this.
This is your turkey neck, I guess, and, you know, I couldn't get rid of it.
Bill was about to turn 70 and feeling depressed.
Yeah, it's even hard to say the age.
For him, getting older means the end of things.
There's nothing really to expect. You usually end up checking the obituary pages. That's about it.
So Bill decided to take some measures. And ahead of his birthday, he decided to cheer himself up with a facelift.
I figured, you know, I have to look in the mirror every morning. And if it's going to make me happier and more motivated to do things, then I will.
A year and a half later, his face still looks pretty good, relatively smooth and no flabby skin hanging under his chin. But when I ask if he's satisfied, Bill says,
I guess. I don't know. When you're looking in the mirror at yourself all the time, you know, you go, is things starting to come back? Am I losing weight? What's going on?
The other thing Bill worried about, at least at the time, was what people would think.
You know, guys don't do that, blah, blah, blah.
Remember, Bill is 70. He grew up in the era of rugged, tough guys. Men who didn't talk about their feelings, much less what they looked like. Guys with a stiff upper lip. Guys like...
Man ought to do what he thinks is best.
John Wayne, you know, be tough and rugged. Who cares what you look like?
That's Fred Fedek. He's a former president of the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery, and someone who's thought a lot about the factors that encourage and discourage men from getting plastic surgery.
There has been a stigma where men are socialized differently. Men are, I think, more private about their looks.
But Fred says that may be changing. Men may be starting to feel a bit more comfortable being uncomfortable about the way they look. For The Pulse, I'm Liz Tung.
Coming up, how we see our bodies and how others see us.
When I was at my smallest, I'd have people still describe me to somebody else as like that big black guy. And I was like not a big black guy at that point.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about our perceptions of beauty and how that ties into our health. We've listened to stories about hair, about skin, and now let's talk about body image and body shapes. Jackson, Mississippi, in the 1980s. Kiese Lehman is a little kid excited for summer to start.
The first day of all the summer camps, you had to go get a physical, you know, to make sure you were fit enough to be in summer camp.
As part of his examination, he had to step on a scale.
And the doctor wrote on my little form a word that I couldn't understand. And I was like a big reader. My mother made me read all the time. And I was like, what does this word mean? And it looked like O-B-I-S.
He tried to convince himself this word meant something good.
Like super strong or something, but I had no proof that that's what it meant. And then I remember these other twins who looked at my form and they were like, man, that says obese, bro. Like, that's not, that doesn't mean strong. that means really fat. I'm laughing about it now, but at the time it was really sad.
Our Our bodies are ours, but how we feel about them is so often defined by others. The things people say, by the society and culture we live in, what kind of body is acceptable or not.
You look weak.
Ooh, that sweater looks kind of tight.
You look like skin and bones.
You're so disgusting.
You're not strong enough to be with the adults.
You're not looking too good. Are you sick?
Kiese Layman wrote a book called Heavy, and it talks a lot about his relationship with his body and his weight, which fluctuated a lot over the years, from being obese to scary skinny. I talked to him in 2018 when the book first came out. When you look at yourself in the mirror now, at your body, what do you see?
Oh, wow. You're starting kind of hard, huh? I see two things. I see a old dude, and I also still see like a young boy. You know, my body went through a lot of different changes. So when I look in mirrors now, I tend to try to just focus on my on my eyes.
As a kid, Kiese was tall for his age and heavy. He was athletic, loved to play sports, but he was always aware of how others perceived his body.
I wanted to try to make people understand that even though I was bigger than most people, like, I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. I wasn't trying to harm anybody. So it made me just really conscious of, like the fear sometimes you could see in people because of the size of my body. And again, it's not just the size. It's, I think it's also that I was, like, a big black boy. And, you know, 11 to 12, people are treating me sort of like I'm a man, you know, because I was pretty big. I looked like a man. Until you came up on me and you saw that. I mean, if you looked at me in the face, you could see I was a boy. But it just meant being treated like a man in places when I actually really just wanted to be treated like a child.
In one of the chapters in Heavy, Kiese describes how his weight totally spiraled out of control during his first semester in college. His mother was doing a postdoc at Harvard at the time, and then they both got home for break.
When you came home for your Christmas break, you looked at me, shook your head, and asked, "What are you doing to yourself? You made me get on the scale in front of you. 256, 264, 269, 272, 275, 287, 296. I asked you to leave and then took off my clothes and tiptoed on the scale again. 293. In one semester, 3.5 months, I gained over 50 pounds.
What do you think was happening with you when you were in college? It seemed like eating was compulsory at that moment.
I mean, college is hard for everybody, but I had just never been around that kind of wealth. I never had to go to sleep and wake up around like lots and lots and lots and lots of white people before. My teachers, for the first time in my life, kind of talked down to me, like treated me like I wasn't smart enough. And so I would go to Waffle House, and then right after Waffle House, I'd go to Dunkin' Donuts. Right after Dunkin' Donuts, I'd go to Taco Bell. Or at the time, it was just like food and eating way too much was the only way, one of the only things I could control. And I just felt full, you know, like in this weird way, like I just needed to feel heavy because I felt so light in other parts of my life. So I think that's what I was doing. Control not just my body but my position in the world.
You and your mother talked about weight quite a bit, and
yes,
it seemed to me that the weight sort of became a stand-in. That was something you could talk about, but you were really talking about like, how are you doing?
Right. Yeah, the weight conversation was definitely a proxy for, you know, the conversations we should have been having about emotionality, about trauma, about our memories, about our fears. And so in absence of that, you know, we could talk about, you know, Key, are you cutting down on your carbs? And my mama would be like, I feel like I lost a little weight today, or I feel like I'm gaining weight today. Or sometimes I really do think we talk about weight when we're afraid or unable to talk about things that might matter more.
After college, Kiese got his first teaching job at Vassar, a liberal arts college in Poughkeepsie, New York. And there, he started to diet obsessively and exercise. He lost a ton of weight. I asked him to read another chapter from Heavy.
The fourth day of my seventh semester at Vassar, I bought a used stair stepper from the gym. After 3 more hours of basketball and an hour of jogging, I maxed the heat in my tiny apartment and stair-stepped until I was down to 165.7 pounds, 60 pounds less than I weighed at 12 years old, and 153.3 pounds less than I weighed at my heaviest. The heaviest version of me was past tense. My current body was present tense. There was no limit to how light I could be, and I knew I needed to live in the future.
I'm wondering if you can elaborate more on the issue of race and how that fits into there's a bigger American conversation or obsession with body and shape, and then race comes into that conversation, gender comes into that conversation. But I'm wondering if you can put your finger on how race fits into this for you and how you felt about your body.
It's interesting. Like, I don't think there's a clear answer, because when I was at my smallest, I think people definitely treated me like I was less obtrusive in space, but I'd have people still describe me to somebody else as like that big black guy. And I was like not a big black guy at that point. You know what I mean? I was the same height I am. Maybe that's what they meant. But I think blackness, and particularly black masculinity, is seen as like something that is potentially like not just space taking up, but also like potentially harmful. And that has something to do with the size of my body, but it has also to do with the way like blackness and black boy bodies and black men bodies, I think, have been treated in this country and definitely where I'm from in Mississippi.
Kiese says writing this book has helped him work on his relationship with his body, to learn to accept it. And he says he understands some of his compulsory habits now.
I have one last question I have to ask you. Have you stopped weighing yourself?
Yes. Yes, I definitely have stopped doing that. Because the problem with me is like once I start weighing myself, I'm not going to stop, right? Like the next day I'm going to try to go do something to try to make that number lower, like in an hour. And then I'm going to try to make that number lower in an hour. Like, I don't know. I can't weigh myself and be healthy. And all I wanted to do actually was just disappear. Like, I just wanted the number to get as low as I could, which ultimately means like I wanted to disappear. And so I'm glad I don't want to disappear anymore. Really glad.
Kiese Lehmann is a writer and author. We talked about his book Heavy, which came out in 2018. He teaches English and creative writing at the University of Mississippi. Our ideas about our own looks start early in life. And when we get feedback on our appearance, it often ties into our notions of self-worth. Because of that, many parents, especially parents of daughters, don't want people to call their girls beautiful. Christine Fennessy has more.
Guess what? I was actually on the radio once.
That's 5-year-old Livia Carlson. She lives near Seattle. Livia is an outgoing kid who loves learning about dinosaurs and playing with her puppy, Raisin. She is also a stunning girl. She has big blue eyes and the kind of hair you see in magazines. Golden ringlets that, according to her mom, Liz Reap Carlson, attract a lot of attention.
People are always saying, "That hair, where did you get those blonde locks?"
They also tell Livia how pretty she is. It happens everywhere. In the grocery store, at the post office, the pharmacy. Liz's gut reaction?
Really, this again, the hair?
Liz doesn't actually say that. She says thank you. She knows people are trying to be friendly. And she knows how it sounds, like, woe is me, I have to field my daughter's compliments all day. But those compliments do worry her.
And I'm at home trying to teach her about how important it is to write and to read and to pursue things that she's curious about and ask questions. But what society constantly reinforces is that she looks pretty and that her hair is nice.
It's tough to know exactly how all the attention affects Livia, but she does not like getting her hair cut.
She's learned very early on that it's an asset, which is not such a bad thing, I suppose, but she has learned that when she dresses up, she gets a lot more attention. I do think it has an impact on her. It makes her a lot more aware of her appearance.
Liz recently cut Livia's hair. It took 2 days of negotiating. But Livia's happy with her new bob. And that's all Liz wants, a happy, confident kid. She knows what can happen when happiness and confidence rely on appearance. When Liz was growing up, she got lots of compliments on her looks. The more attention she paid to her clothes and her hair, the more praise she got. She came to believe that nothing mattered as much as being pretty. Eventually, for her, pretty came to mean thin, very thin.
I went into the hospital in college because I was afraid I was going to die. At that point, I was 19 and I had been actively anorexic or bulimic for 7 years.
She knows her experience makes her super sensitive to what people say to Livia. But she also thinks that focusing on Livia's appearance sells her kids short. She would love if conversations with Livia expanded to something like,
tell me a little bit more about what you're up to. I see you got your soccer cleats on, you know, or what grade are you in? You look like you're about, what's a five-year-old into these days?
I asked some other parents if their girls get compliments for their appearance and how they feel about it.
My name is Jung Kim Cleese. I don't really like word like beautiful or gorgeous. I tell my daughter, you look so strong or you look so healthy. I think chiribri comes from the inside.
And here's Richard Allen. He has two daughters, and he says how he reacts when people call them beautiful depends on who it is.
If it's someone who knows them, I feel like they should really try harder. Because if they have a relationship with my girls, I would like them to make comments based on the interactions that they've had with my girls. But if it's someone who is meeting them for the first time and they say that, I don't get offended. Frankly, I think they're right.
But many psychologists believe that appearance-based comments are harmful. When kids are constantly praised for being beautiful, they can develop what's called a fixed mindset. Basically, they start to believe their value is dependent on their looks. And so all their time and energy go into maintaining that value. And if those compliments stop coming, they can feel like a failure.
I did all this.
That's 6-year-old Adeline Taylor. She's showing me her painting.
So it's like a forest with, and these yellow spots are actually fireflies.
It's kind of Van Gogh-ish. Adeline comes by her talent naturally. Her mom, Tricia Samuel, is an art teacher and an artist herself.
In the fine art world, I do portraits. And my favorite is to do people. There's just something really beautiful about looking at someone's portrait and seeing how extraordinarily unique they are.
Tricia also has a son, Marshall, who's almost 3.
It was very interesting to realize that he was getting the same amount of attention. And I don't know, I think maybe stereotypically I thought that only a girl would get those beautiful comments, but he gets them just as often.
The comments typically come from older women. And while Tricia supports those who advocate against labeling kids like that, she understands why it happens. She's an artist. She gets it. We live in a visual culture. We're almost hardwired to comment on things we enjoy looking at. She also sees these comments as an opportunity for a more meaningful interaction.
I think the reason that I don't get upset is that I just feel like our purpose in life is to connect with each other. So I don't want to shame people into changing. I want to connect with them.
She works hard to explain to her kids that beauty glows from the inside. And so far, Adeline seems to get it. When people say she's beautiful, she thanks them. She thinks it's so nice. She says, it's really fun for me. But when they don't say anything about how she looks?
Yeah, I kind of like just roll with it. Because that's what 6-year-olds do.
That story was reported by Christine Fennessy. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jed Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.